From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Washington, D.C. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, I really want you to know how grateful we are for that gift. Thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Some critics are particularly worried about our national parks. Part of Trump's plan to lower the national debt would involve selling U.S. assets. And a committee within the Republican Party voted to make the return of federal lands to the states a party platform.
You may not have known this, but Sunday, April 28th marks the end of National Parks Week. At a time when political commitment to the environment seems at a low in our country, a new book celebrating the priceless inspiration available in the territories set aside for all of us to enjoy has just appeared. The title is America's Holy Ground, and you'll meet co-author Brad Lyons.
We will persist and we will resist because our democracy depends on it. We depend on it. Our children and our grandchildren depend on us.
The American cultural landscape has been transformed in the past 8 years, and among those most affected have been women and Jewish persons. A prominent leader at the intersection of those populations, Nancy Kaufman, has helmed the National Council of Jewish Women for those same 8 years, and we'll get her insights and observations later in this week's show. But first,
grieving families in Sri Lanka continue to mourn victims of Sunday's coordinated bomb attacks.
We're at a point where news comes at us so quickly and from so many directions that the Easter Sunday bloodbath that devastated the South Asian country of Sri Lanka seems like something that happened quite a while ago. It's only been 1 week. The series of coordinated attacks have claimed at least 360 lives. The horror of a religious ideology being associated with an attack of this scale, or any violence for that matter, cannot be overstated. But somehow, survivors of the attack need to go on, and they need to do so in a nation with a rich history of religious diversity. The Reverend Dr. Shanta Premawardhana has spent years in interfaith leadership roles in Sri Lanka, and I am so grateful to welcome him to State of Belief Radio. Shanta and I have been friends for a long, long time. Shanta, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Welton. It's a great opportunity to be with you. I appreciate that.
Well, sadly, most Americans know little or less about the religious landscape in a place like Sri Lanka. So would you start with a brief description of the interfaith environment in Sri Lanka?
Yes, of course. Sri Lanka is a largely Buddhist country. About 70% of the population of 22 million are Buddhist. The version of Buddhism is Theravada Buddhism, and Buddhists believe that the Buddha himself gave them the mandate to protect Buddhism in Sri Lanka, in that country. Apart from Buddhists, there are Hindus. Buddhists are the Sinhala population, ethnic-wise. The Hindus are the Tamil population, and they are about 12% of the population. Muslims are next, about 9.7, and Muslims in any other religious tradition not a monolithic group. They had several versions of Islam in Sri Lanka, and there are Christians who make up about 7% of the population. Mm. Again, a very diverse group of people that lived in harmony for a very long time. Occasional conflicts have arisen, some having to do with the long history of colonialism Sri Lanka has had, 450 years of that, during which time Buddhism was threatened. And as a result, when independence came in 1948, there was a Sinhala Buddhist nationalism that arose, which created some tensions within the religious communities.
Shanta, did people of different faiths view the Easter attacks in sectarian terms?
That's a puzzle that we are still trying to sort out. An Islamic group within Sri Lanka has been identified as the perpetrators. They are a Wahhabi group. Wahhabis are very ultra-conservative Muslims. It's a sect that arose out of Saudi Arabia and has been making incursions into South Asia over the past two or three decades. So this group is the one that has been identified as the perpetrators, although ISIS has claimed responsibility and obviously was supporting this group. The question that we've struggled with, and I continue to struggle with, is why this set of people, how were they targeted? The interesting thing is that two large Catholic churches were targeted and one large evangelical church. It is learned from reliable sources that the target was not the evangelical church, but the Catholic cathedral that was down the block. And so you got to ask, why three Catholic churches? That's one set of questions. The other set of questions has to do with why luxury hotels? These are five-star hotels that were attacked. Mm-hmm. And there are many theories, of course.
I'm curious as to whether or not there had been tensions on the ground that could have foreshadowed something like this happening in Sri Lanka. Was it a surprise, or was it something that people said they anticipated that?
What is interesting is that we've had a 26-year-long war, and that war was over in 2009, just 10 years ago. Yeah. So we've had a relative period of peace. The war was not a religious one, but it had an ethnic base. So apart from the fact that the country was traumatized for that period of time, there was no religious base to that. For 10 years, we've had a season of peace, but there were various incursions that happened over the period of the war. A group of extremist Buddhists arose, and mobs incited by extremist Buddhist monks would attack churches, Christian churches, and pastors and Christian people early on because of the movement of evangelical churches that were being established in many different parts of the country. And then secondly, attacks against Muslims took place over the past few years, including one very serious set of activities 1 year ago in different parts of the country. And that too is because of what people felt was the encroaching Wahhabism within the country. Mm-hmm. So whenever there was a perception that foreign influences are coming into the country, there were extremist Buddhists that would do that. Mm-hmm. The issue that these people who did the bombing, the issue they should have had, one might say, is with the extremist Buddhists. Mm-hmm. Christians are a religious minority, just like Muslims are. In fact, they've worked together for a very long time without much incident. Mm-hmm. So that was a huge surprise that a group of extremist Muslims would attack churches. Mm.
In 2016, the U.S. State Department asked me to go to Sri Lanka and work with leaders of the various religions there. I have to say, I was extremely impressed by the resolve of religious leaders to work on good relations with each other, has that changed? Is there a deep divide among interreligious groups in Sri Lanka now? What's going to be the aftermath of what has happened here?
The interreligious relationships are very strong. We also have interfaith peacemaker teams arising from the grassroots level that bring people together from different religions to work together on issues that are critical for them as they decide that. The challenge right now is that Muslim community in Sri Lanka is being threatened. I'm not sure by who, but the communal threats are there to the Muslim community. The religious leadership, I've talked to my colleagues in Sri Lanka, we've talked about how our interfaith peacemaker teams need to work to protect the threatened Muslim community right now, and the repercussions of that may go on for a period of time. So the interfaith community needs to come together in order to make that happen. Just some ways very similar to what happened to the Muslim community immediately after 9/11 in the United States.
Shanta, you're being very humble, but these interfaith peacemaker teams are a part of what you have been doing in Sri Lanka. And I want to ask, how did you get involved in the interfaith work there? And talk about what these interfaith peacemaker teams have been organized to do in Sri Lanka.
Thank you for the opportunity, Welton. We are an organization that came together to consider how we can address religious extremism and religion-based oppression, domination, and violence. And we began this work in Nigeria, in the northeast of Nigeria, where Boko Haram has been active, and we brought Muslims and Christians together. And we have a significant number of interfaith peacemaker teams in villages around the state of Gombe in northeast Nigeria. We took the idea to Sri Lanka because, obviously, it was easy for me to do. I knew the players, the religious leaders, the political leaders, and so on. And to establish these teams in villages at the grassroots level. What we do is we give them a training in how we can relate across the religions, breaking down the exclusivity and the attitude of superiority that each religion has, and allowing for a new a theology to arise from the ground up based on the questions and the struggles of the people on the ground. So we teach them how to relate across the religions and collaborate across religions and to build power so that they can actually act in an effective way. This has been going on relatively new in Sri Lanka, but it's been going on in Nigeria for a few years. And what we've done is we've taken that model, and my colleague in Sri Lanka is a retired Anglican bishop. He wrote in his letter today that he sent out to his constituency that the answer to this kind of problem is nothing other than interfaith peacemaker teams, and we need to have them in every village in Sri Lanka.
It's critically important that we not disregard parts of the world that might not get a lot of media coverage here in the United States, but that we need to know that our lives are interconnected with their lives. What do you wish every American would take the time to think about in the aftermath of this tragedy?
What a great question, Welton. I think you set it up very nicely, that we in the United States would understand more clearly and more deeply the interconnectedness that we have. Groups like ISIS are forcing us to do that because it is their handiwork, what we saw on Easter Sunday. And what we saw is for the Christian community here, our Christian brothers and sisters who got hit by this more than anyone else, they are the ones who suffer. And if we take solace in any biblical idea that Christians find very important, It is the idea that we are members of one body. And when one part of the body suffers, everybody is in pain. That's the idea I hope we will take and understand that we are all connected. And so what's going on in Sri Lanka today has a direct connection to our lives here today.
The Reverend Dr. Shanta Premawardhana is president of the Omnia Institute for Contextual Leadership. He is the past director of interreligious dialogue and cooperation at the World Council of Churches and associate general secretary for interfaith relations at the National Council of Churches of Christ. Shanta, it is so good to hear your voice. So thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Welton. Really appreciate the opportunity to speak to you.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. I'll talk with the outgoing CEO of the National Council of Jewish Women, Nancy Kaufman, and later the co-author of a new book about experiencing our national parks from a spiritual perspective, Brad Lyons. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Nancy J. Kaufman has a distinguished record of activism and public service that spans decades. For the past 8 years, she has devoted herself to the role of CEO at the National Council of Jewish Women. As she prepares to move on to her next challenge, I'm grateful to have Nancy Kaufman join us in the studio today. Nancy, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
For listeners who may not be familiar with the National Council of Jewish Women, would you talk about the origins of the organization and what it does today?
Well, interestingly enough, the National Council of Jewish Women was founded in 1893 in Chicago, Illinois, by a Jewish woman by the name of Hannah G. Solomon. Hannah G. Solomon was a member of the Reform movement of Judaism. She was at a time in American life and in Jewish life when women weren't exactly welcomed around most tables and didn't perform leadership roles in most places. She was invited to represent the Jewish community and bring volunteers to the Academy of World Religions at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893. And when she arrived to be there to volunteer, she was asked to pour the tea. And she said, "Jewish women can do more than pour tea." And they walked out. And that was the beginning. She went back to Chicago. Her contemporaries at the time were Jane Addams from the Settlement House Movement and Susan B. Anthony. And she said, "I'm going to organize Jewish women to make a difference in the world and show the world that we as Jewish women have something to give back." And that was the origin of the National Council of Jewish Women. It started with one section, they called it. It was conceived it as sort of sections of an orange, and that we'd have all the sections would make up a whole. And then one by one started organizing sections across the country and ultimately internationally. The purpose of NCJW, and we've been around for 125 years, we're celebrating our 125th anniversary. So the original purpose was to help immigrant women, to provide for all immigrant women, not just Jewish immigrant women. We were the first NGO to actually have permission at Ellis Island to welcome women coming off the boats to prevent them from being trafficked and sold into prostitution. So we have a sort of illustrious and long history of being activists in the issues of the day.
Do you embrace all of the various Jewish groups?
Yes, yes. We're a non-denominational organization, which was another attraction. We cut across religious, non-religious, non-affiliated Jewish women, non-Jewish women who want to, you know, participate through a Jewish lens. We're inspired by Jewish values, but our organization is not National Council for Jewish Women. I always correct people. You said it right. It's National Council of Jewish Women on behalf, based on Jewish values of social justice and really Kavod Habriyot and B'Tselem Elohim, the dignity of every human being. And that's sort pretty much has guided our agenda for the last 125 years.
As you prepare to end your tenure at NCJW, how does the cultural landscape today differ from what that landscape looked like 8 years ago?
I would say in the last 8 years, we've attracted more and more younger women. We have developed a greater online presence, and the use of social media has been huge. And as the situation has gotten more and more challenging here in Washington and in state capitals across the country, we have really stepped up our activism around the issues that we really have worked on, you know, for years: voting rights and reproductive rights and immigrant rights. These are issues that we have worked on, you know, for over 100 years, and we feel are really threatened right now. And so we've had greater activism on those issues.
When you took this leadership role 8 years ago, what were the areas of greatest concern at that point?
Well, first of all, I'm the first CEO in 125 years. NCJW functioned as an operating board, not a governing board, which meant the board, kind of the women were in charge. They saw the need to bring to professionalize and bring in a professional leader. So I came in as the CEO 8 years ago. When I came in, we had a plethora of issues. We're a multi-issue organization, so we were working on a lot. But it's very hard to work on a lot and be and have an impact on everything. So what I did was I tried to narrow the focus and really zero in on those areas where other faith-based organizations in the Jewish world were not working. The landscape has changed. There was a time when NCJW, National Council of Jewish Women, and the Reform Movement of Judaism were the only sort of really social activist organizations in the Jewish landscape. And that has changed significantly. And before I came to NCJW, I was working in the Jewish community in Boston, and I saw it before my eyes. Over the last 30 years, you've seen a huge sea change: the number of smaller boutique organizations, the number of organizations working with 20s and 30s, driven out of a concern about Jewish continuity and about intermarriage, and, you know, how do we act on our Jewish values? And, you know, that was what was feeding it. What I've always said about NCJW, the wonderful thing is that we didn't have to change because we are who we are and who we've always been. The landscape changed, the competition changed, but the issues have stayed the same. We decided that we would focus in and take the lead on those issues that other Jewish faith-based organizations were not taking the lead. So reproductive health rights and justice has been an issue for us from time immemorial, but it's also an issue when I sit around the table with Planned Parenthood and with NARAL and these organizations. Not only am I usually the only faith-based organization around the table, sometimes Catholics for Choice is there, but I'm also the only Jewish representative around the table. So that's been a huge area. We've stayed true to that and gotten much more focused on that. The second area that we have had a 20-year history is the importance of the federal courts, something that no one was paying any attention to for a long time. And we have been involved in a project called Benchmark, working on behalf of a fair and independent judiciary for many, many years, knowing that the pipeline that comes through the federal courts and who gets appointed to federal courts becomes the pipeline that goes to the Supreme Court, and that the issues that we all care deeply about end up very often in the Supreme Court. Now, we're seeing that more and more. So we became very, very involved in organizing and educating around the importance of the courts. The third area that we really pivoted on, we always were involved in voting rights, but we really pivoted after the 2016 election around the issue of civic engagement. The importance of not only voting and protecting the right of people to vote, but really grassroots organizing, community organizing, to ensure that candidates running for office were a 501c3, so we don't take a position on candidates, but the candidates are addressing the issues that we feel are important to address. And so we do take positions on issues, and we do take positions on ballot initiatives. And we became much more activist-oriented. We introduced community organizing. We taught community organizing. And we introduced courageous conversations where we are women who really, the women of NCJW, as an organization, we have a foot in the mainstream and we have a foot in the progressive world. And there are not that many organizations that kind of can talk to both sides. And we try to use that in order to influence and create change at the local level.
What would you say before the election of Donald Trump was the biggest piece of your work? And then how much did the landscape shift after the 2016 election and change what you were doing?
Well, look, the warning signs were on the horizon since the midterm elections in 2014 and even before, really, because we, even with Obama as president, you saw the red flags around the issue of reproductive health rights and justice, the Hobby Lobby decision by the Supreme Court, the fraying of the separation of religion and state, which, you know, we have been, you know, strong advocates for. That was already happening in the Obama administration. So we had been already sort of gearing up for that fight and those fights and really trying to remind people of the importance of not only of the courts and that they're ultimately going to be the decision makers. So we saw the warning signs on the horizon. We saw the warning signs on the horizon around immigrant rights. I mean, we all know that we had a broken immigration policy. There was attempts to create and pass comprehensive immigration reform. It didn't happen. We knew that what was happening with deportations, you know, even in that administration, and the lack of having a comprehensive immigration reform policy was creating enormous stresses. And, you know, we saw that coming. Voting rights, you know, the complete diminutization of voting rights and not protecting people and what was happening in the polling. And I mean, this goes back to Gore Bush. And, you know, this was coming for a long time. And, you know, our democracy and the question of what does it mean to have our democracy. So all of these things were things that we were watching very carefully, not to mention our fears about Roe v. Wade and our continued fears about Roe v. Wade, our concerns about access to affordable health care, Affordable Care Act we were extremely involved in, but then protecting the Affordable Care Act and making sure that it stayed intact, contraception and the ability to access contraception, the ability of poor, you know, even in the Obama administration, the Hyde Amendment, which prevents low-income women from getting an abortion if they are on federal, if they receive federal funding through Medicaid or even if they're in the military or any other federal funding, is just outrageous that I can, as a, you know, middle-class Jewish woman, have access to an abortion, but, you know, a poor person can't. Those were the questions that were bubbling up already before 2016. I think what 2016 was a wake-up call, particularly for women, because 53% of women voted for Donald Trump, 53% of white women, that, wait a minute, what's happening? And I think what we saw was an incredible outpouring of desire to be able to take effective action. And where am I going to do that action?
Yeah. This era has also brought an increased awareness of anti-Semitism and harassment of women in our nation. Is that going to be a real wake-up call in those areas as well?
Well, let's hope so. I think you have to be very thoughtful about analyzing what this new anti-Semitism is. There's been a 56% increase in anti-Semitic acts since Donald Trump was elected. Words make a difference. And when you respond to a Charlottesville saying both sides are, you know, have good points, when people are marching saying Jews will not replace us and people with guns are standing in front of the synagogue, you begin to really understand that this white nationalism that we're really living under not only is bad for the Jews and bad for blacks and bad for women and bad for gays, you know, we're all in this together. So I think the intersectionality, not to use an overused term, of understanding the dynamics. Having said that, what it's also unleashed is anti-Semitism on the left. Not the same. I think that the anti-Semitism on the right has been violent anti-Semitism. It resulted in Tree of Life, you know, synagogue and a horrific killing of 11 people while they were praying. I mean, you know, or Muslims, you know, while they're in prayer, or Christians while they're in prayer. I mean, it really, it's a very, very scary and frightening phenomenon. I think the anti-Semitism on the left is also of concern. It's more words, not deeds, in terms of the actual incidents. I think it comes from a real ignorance about Judaism, who we are, what we are. I think there's enormous need for education. So in that way, yes, there may be a silver lining where people need to start understanding. I think the anti-Semitism on the left, also there's a fine line between anti-Israel and anti-Semitism. I don't think everyone who criticizes the government of Israel or certain things in Israel is an anti-Semite, just like I don't think everyone who criticizes our government is anti-American. But you know, it's a fine line. And so we are trying, because we work both in Israel and the United States, and we work on progressive issues here and there. We work with feminists in Israel and building a civil society, and we care deeply. And so I think we need to sort of sort this out and unpack it and really be in conversations with people about it.
Is there one accomplishment by NCJW that you would point to as having a lasting positive impact on our nation?
Well, there's many. I think you know, one of the biggest ones has been our advocacy in the courts. I mean, I really think that our work in educating people in terms of the courts and the importance of the courts and monitoring who is being appointed to the courts and speaking out about that has been huge. We're known for it. It's been very, very significant. And we're the only Jewish organization and probably only faith-based organization who's made this a priority. So I think that's huge in terms of us taking the lead. And that's obviously in the United States. I think in terms of internationally in Israel, we have just finished a cohort. We brought a group of 17 feminists from Israel to the United States for our Washington conference that we just finished. And there were three Palestinians. There was LGBT. There was disabled people. There were Mizrahi and Ashkenazi, and it was really a diverse group of individuals. And we brought them together because we're trying to build a leadership cohort of women, because we do believe it will be women, both in this country and that country, who might lead us out of the morass, to develop. It's a one-year fellowship program, basically, to develop a leadership cohort. The goal of this is we're trying to connect for impact and strengthen the feminist ecosystem in Israel. I think that's huge, and I think we're the only ones doing that.
Yeah. Nancy, so many worthy causes are always competing for the public's attention and support. You've been spectacularly effective at raising the profile of NCJW as well as motivating supporters. I wonder if there are some lessons that you've learned from your success that you'd be willing to share.
Yes, I think you need to remember who your base is. You got to remember. I'm by initial training a community organizer. I started out as a grassroots community organizer in the anti-poverty movement back in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, we learned then, and I still think it's true now, that you need to listen and relate to the people that make up your base. Mm-hmm. And our base is Jewish women who want to make a difference in the world and defined in different ways. I think you always need to go back to your base. So I have been very committed to the grassroots and the importance of supporting our grassroots as we move through the halls of power, you know, here in Washington. Last week when we were at Washington Institute 2 weeks ago, we visited over 150 congressional offices. These women were carrying their NCJW bags, and they were going to meet with their elected officials from their communities across the country. We are strong in almost all the states, but I think, you know, we have 25 states where we have full-time volunteer state policy advocates. So the idea of knowing how to put your words into action. We talk about putting our faith into action. I mean, we're really putting our faith into action. It's understanding the J in NCJW. Why is this a Jewish organization? I said in my closing speech 2 weeks ago, I said, we've got to remember that we're not the National Organization for Women. It's a great organization. I was a member for many years. We're the National Council of Jewish Women. And we need to understand, and we need to understand what our Jewish roots are and what those Jewish values are that inform us. On the other hand, we're for all people, and it's based on our commitment to social justice and that we take seriously as Jews, but it's universal. So it's particular and it's universal. And I think that what differentiates NCJW from the rest of the landscape is both that mix of being a faith-based Jewish organization and being responding and including the grassroots in both the United States and Israel. So here we are, a progressive Jewish women's organization that embraces our support for Israel, albeit sometimes challenging, and we're proud of it. So when I'm asked the question about intersectionality, which I'm often asked, I say I'm a pro-Israel Zionist feminist, progressive Zionist feminist that cares about the rights of Palestinians. That's who I am. And I hold all those identities, and I have no problem holding all of those identities. And I'll, talk to anyone who wants to challenge any one of those identities. So I think that that's really important. I think remembering who your base is, being able to hear and learn and understand that it's not the same in all 50 states. Jews' experience in New York City is different than Omaha, Nebraska, or in Kansas, or in Texas. And we have a presence in all those places. And we're really a gateway for women who really want to be taking action and making a difference in the world. And we're intergenerational. I should mention that. We're intergenerational. We don't discriminate against any age group, which is different. There are a lot of groups focused on young people, not enough focused on older people. But we are intergenerational, and that's an exciting thing. So at our conference 2 weeks ago, half the people there were first-timers. And I'd say, a quarter, maybe a third of the people were probably under 40, and probably two-thirds were over. And, it was a real mix of ages and groups. That makes us very unique.
From what you've been doing, the priorities on which you've worked, as you move out of this particular job, are you positive or negative?
I'm very positive. I'm an optimist. I have to be an optimist or I wouldn't be able to do this work. And it's been hard. The last couple of years certainly has been challenging, and there's been more losses than wins. But I think, that if you believe in democracy and you believe in making a difference in the world, then you got to keep working at it. And I like to remind people, and I've been reminding people, I'm not retiring, I'm rewiring. Mm-hmm. And I plan to continue doing this work and trying to really lift up the Jewish social justice combo that I think is very important.
Nancy Kaufman is the outgoing CEO of the National Council of Jewish Women. You can learn more about the organization at ncjw.org. Nancy, thank you so much for coming in to be with us today on State of Belief Radio. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
This weekend marks the end of the annual National Parks Week, designed to raise awareness and appreciation of the land set aside for all to enjoy. The celebration came in an era when both public lands and environmental commitments are under threat from this administration's priorities. A new book, just published by Chalice Press, invites us to ponder the special spiritual offerings of these natural places. The title is America's Holy Ground, 61 Faithful Reflections on Our National Parks. And I'm happy to have co-author Brad Lyons, who also just happens to be the publisher at Chalice Press, join us on State of Belief Radio. Brad, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
What made you write this book?
That's a really good question. Thank you. I appreciate it. It was a ton of fun to write. It really started as just a kind of a crazy conversation that my co-author Bruce Barkhauer and I were having one night about how we just loved our national parks and the different experiences we had had in them. Bruce is a minister in the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, and I'm a lay leader. But you know, we were both able to see the holy connections right away, and we went, you know, there may be something here. And so we talked about it for a couple of years and realized this is a book. So we talked about it here in the office and decided to make a run at it. And so Bruce and I divvied up the national parks. We each came up with our own themes and found a scripture that would work with each one, and off we went. Mm. So that's basically how the book was written, is that we absorbed this lifetime of experiences and somehow managed to convert it into actual words.
Well, describe for our listeners, if you would, the structure of America's Holy Ground.
Each of the 61 national parks is included in this book. And so the national parks are the ones that have been approved by Congress. There are a lot of places that folks think are national parks, but they are a little bit different, like Mount Rushmore, Devil's Tower, and some stuff like that. It's a different kind of national park. These hit the big ones, like Yellowstone, Yosemite, Shenandoah, Great Smoky Mountain, those kinds of larger mm-hmm. ones. So each one of these, we open up with the name of the park, what state it's in, when it became a national park. And then we have found, like I said, a scripture that seems to go with the theme that we have selected. Bruce and I picked 61 unique themes, one for every park. And then we wrote a short essay that describes the park, describes some of the things you'll find when you visit, and some of the experiences you may have when you're there. Towards the end of that essay, we look at those particular aspects, those particular traits that we matched up with the parks, and then each devotion ends with three questions. One that helps you reflect on your own personal journey, and another one that helps you reflect on how you can help others in their journey, and then the third one's kind of a wild card. So each one of those has a facilitated, guided meditation for you at the conclusion.
Have you always felt this connection between faith and flora?
You know, yes and no. It's not something I was able to put my finger on when I was young. It's the kind of thing that's only come around in the last 4 or 5 years, I think. But I've always had that kind of sense of the bigger world around me. Mm-hmm. When you grow up on the prairies of Oklahoma and you see a thunderstorm at 50,000 feet coming your way, it helps you realize how small you are in the midst of all of God's creation.
Yeah. In recent years, we've seen growing commitment to environmental matters from a range of religious traditions. With the threats to some of our national parks in the past couple of years from the administration, have you seen any pushback from faith-based groups defending those lands?
I think that there is a pushback from faith-based groups, but I think they're part of a larger coalition. I think a lot of the faith-based groups are letting the groups that have had the environmental credibility mm-hmm. and clout take the lead on that. But I do think there are a significant community. There's a significant community of faith-based environmental activists.
Brad, do you have a favorite meditation in this book or a favorite place among all these parks? And if you do, tell me about it.
Yes, I have a favorite. When Bruce and I divvied these up, we kind of did it like you would do a fantasy football draft. And so I knew who my first pick was, and it was Yellowstone. Yellowstone was the very first one I picked. And I do have a God moment there. Back in 1995, I was 20-something years old, and I was a journalist. I had been working in Oklahoma City, and if you remember your American history, that was the year that the federal building was bombed. And I covered that event and the aftermath for months. And so I was really shaken by that. We went on vacation, and we ended up at Mesa Verde and at Arches and a couple of other national parks, Grand Teton. But we finally ended up in Yellowstone. And I went out to watch Old Faithful erupt one night in the dark. and about 10:30, 11 at night. And as I was out there and looking at the stars, I realized the Perseid meteor shower was going on. This once a year event that I was out here in the darkness of Yellowstone, and it made me remember what we are called to do in the world. We are called to make the world a better place for each other, to work for justice and equality, to see what God wants us to be. My mind went way off the track into the wilderness while I was sitting out there, but it's one of those moments that I'm so glad I had. I actually found myself looking at the picture I took of Old Faithful erupting in the dark just last night, and still, you know, 25 years later, it's still an amazing experience to have had. But Yellowstone is still my holy ground.
You're co-author of America's Holy Ground, but you're also the publisher at Chalice Press.
Right.
We have featured several of your authors on State of Belief and have a couple more lined up for this summer already. Would you talk about the origins of the press and the broadening ground that you're working to cover?
Sure, I'd be happy to. The Christian Board of Publication is kind of our given name, our baptism name. That's the CBP was founded in 1911 by a group of men here in St. Louis who wanted to provide a publishing house for what eventually has become the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, one of the mainline denominations that's got about 400,000 members right now. So CBP has been in St. Louis for over a century, and the Chalice Press imprint has been around for 25, 30 years or so. Where we are right now is recognizing that we have the opportunity to have a larger audience because the disciples have an opportunity to have a larger audience. Where disciples align on the theological spectrum is being open to all, welcoming to all. Christ invited us all to the communion table with no exceptions. That's where we come from as a publisher. We want to have a diverse author base. We want to have a diverse readership. We want to make sure that everybody who is interested in thinking about their faith, their Christian faith, in a broad, inviting, welcoming way, we want to make sure that they have those resources. So that's where Chalice Press has been working over the last decade or so to broaden that out and make sure that that invitation is heard far and wide.
We've seen several dogma-driven religious publishers reject manuscripts from authors that deviated from strict doctrinaire strictures. And I'm not talking about denominational publishers, but imprints that cater to religious readers. On the other hand, you are broadening the range of authors that you're taking on. And so I wonder what comes into play as you make those decisions and whether you find yourself worrying about changing what Chalice Press means to readers.
So, yeah, what comes into play as we're discussing bringing a title on board is one of the things we've put in our contracts for the last few years is that we reserve the right to reject any book or to edit a book if it has any kind of language that is not inclusive. And so the authors, when they sign the contract, they see that. That's in there. It's on the same page as their signature. I have yet to have an issue with that. I think that's one of the things that our authors pride themselves on is knowing that they are part of a progressive publishing house. In terms of how that plays in the larger marketplace, it is a challenge. There's no question about that. There are a lot of Christian bookstores that won't look at what we do because we don't adhere to those kind of rigid dogma. That said, you know, the Christian audience in terms of books is undergoing some massive shifts in just the past 2 years with the closures of Family Christian and now Lifeway and closing their brick and mortar stores. The whole marketplace, publishing is a tough world anyway. So Christian publishing is even tougher in that sense. The whole marketplace is in transformation right now. As society views Christianity in a different way, I think we're going to see those market trends shift a little bit, and that there's going to be somewhat of a leveling of the playing field, which I think gives us a great opportunity to be an emerging publisher for the progressive Christian voice in the next decade or two.
What's the biggest challenge that you face in running a specialty book publishing enterprise?
Yeah, visibility in the industry.
And what about the digital age? Does that make a difference?
You know, digital is important, but it's not as important. My read on this. This is purely my opinion on this. My sense is that digital and e-books help raise visibility and make it easier to get books. But I think in the nonfiction and religious side, at least my sense is that that's not as important a part as it is for like the fiction side. You know, there's these numbers that fly around about what percentage of books sold are digital. And I think that a lot of folks buy books that they're only going to read once digitally. I think that books on faith are bought and to be read repeatedly or shared. And I think that makes the tangible, printable, hand it to your friend kind of print book much more useful than an electronic book. Now, there's other resources, and as church evolves and as we see things like hymnals being replaced by PowerPoint presentations, that's a challenge.
Yeah.
But we're working to overcome that as well. But all of our books are available digitally these days, at least all of our new ones. So we are working to address that. You know, the biggest challenge for us as a small publisher is that visibility, is trying to make sure that folks can see us. There's a certain web company that is named after a large South American river that runs this industry, and they have totally transformed it in the last two decades. And that is a big challenge for a lot of us. I don't think there's a publisher out there who hasn't had to deal in some way with Amazon.
Yeah.
And that makes it a real challenge because they are doing to publishing and to retail what Walmart did in the 90s to retail, and just totally transforming the way it works. So that's the biggest challenge, is just getting out there and getting seen.
Brad, last question. Can I ask you, what is the greatest source of satisfaction for you that you've experienced in doing this work?
That's a real meaningful question. I am humbled when I see what our authors do, when I see our authors out there combating racism and combating classism and LGBTQ phobia, when I see what our authors are doing every day to make this world a better place for all of us, how can you not be proud? Yeah. How can you not be humbled? How can you not know that you are doing what you feel is a holy calling? That's what I really appreciate at the end of the day.
Well said, and I have to congratulate you on America's Holy Ground. It's not only a meaningful book, it's a beautiful book, and people should really enjoy it.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Brad Lyons is publisher at Chalice Press and the co-author of the new book, America's Holy Ground, 61 Faithful Reflections on Our National Parks. Brad, it's been so fascinating for me, and it's great to talk with you. I hope we can have you back with us again soon. You're always welcome on State of Belief Radio.
I would welcome that conversation. Thank you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say again, thank you very much. Your generous support of this program is vital to keeping us on the air. Now, if you think there's value in what you've heard, and you think it's important that others hear it as well, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Conversations are going on there that you need to be a part of. You can make a contribution. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.